Hey, everybody, this is Chris. Welcome to the Sausage of Science. I'm getting started just a little bit early today because we're under a little bit of a time crunch. Eric will be joining me as co-host, and I wanted to go ahead and introduce you to our guest today. Today, we're going to talk to Dr. Julian Rutherford, who I've been trying to get on the show for a long, long time. Dr. Rutherford's professor and John and Nell Mitchell Endowed Chair for Pediatric Nursing at the University of Arizona College of Nursing. She is a biological anthropologist, and her work integrates bioanthropotheory with biomedical science. For the past 20 years, she's actually sustained a program studying intrauterine environments as a biosocial determinant of health. She also studies maternal life history and how lived experience shape this early developmental setting. We'll be talking all about that stuff. One of the main areas or main foci of her work are marmosets. So her innovative marmoset research comprises the bulk of her 16 years of continuous federal funding. As a PI, she designed a womb-to-womb project that we'll be talking to her about today. She and her team have shown that the mother's birth weight and litter size are associated with pregnancy outcomes of the children in later adulthood, and then the reproductive development of daughters. I might have gotten that flip-flop, but she's going to get on here in just a second and straighten this out. These studies demonstrate the ways maternal and child outcomes can be shaped by events beyond the reach of individual agency. And then she applies this justice-informed lens in collaborations with nurse midwifery scholars and others to examine things like COVID-19 directed changes in care, obstetric racism, a whole smorgasbord of topics. And we got two articles we're going to talk to her about today. We're going to talk to her about the main womb-to-womb article that came out in 2021, womb-to-womb maternal litter size and birth weight, but not adult characteristics predict early neonatal death of offspring in the common marmoset monkey. That was in PLOS One. And then we're also going to talk to her about a co-authored piece with Caroline Van Sickle and Kaelise. I probably got the name pronunciation wrong, so apologies. It's called Textbook Typologies, Challenging the Myth of the Perfect Obstetric Pelvis. So in just a few minutes, we will have Eric joining me as co-host and Dr. Rutherford joining us as well. I want to thank all you listeners out there for continuing to follow along with the Sausage of Science. And as you've probably noticed, we have a continually changing casts of co-hosts, and we hope to keep that going. We're training folks up in public engagement, science communication. We will be recruiting new junior service fellows for our producer jobs probably around the end of summer. So if you are interested, go ahead and reach out to me at cdlin@ua.edu or find me on the socials and let me know. Here's my co-host right now. What's up, Eric?
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Recording is in progress, and I did the intro.
Yeah, we had some calendar snafus, but we're all here finally.
We are all here finally. Many calendar snafus, people flying back and forth, AA, BA, HBA meetings. People have excuses.
Yeah, I just got back from the meeting on Sunday morning. We missed you, Chris. Where were you?
I was playing hooky. I couldn't after all the big talk, considering I'm flying away for 2 months a week from yesterday, I just didn't have the bandwidth. Plus I still had like 700,000 things to do at home. So when the heart palpitations kicked in and I was dry heaving, my wife was like, I think you need to take something off your plate.
Well, skipping Los Angeles is probably a good city to miss on.
A lot of people I knew were not going to be there. And then I sort of put it out there and I was like, I'm sorry to everyone on the EC, da da da. Someone was like, yeah, I, you know, had a year where my dog was sick and I had something going on and I just couldn't do it either. So, you know, how are you? Staying busy?
Staying busy, catching like, so we're recording on the Tuesday. So I just got back less than, it must be just 2.5 days ago. So cleaning out the email inbox on Monday and then actually trying to work again on Tuesday.
People, we haven't really announced this at all, but we I was gonna be there for this grand thing that we didn't actually plan, but we have a new logo and we made stickers. Which you may have noticed because it's been in the feed for a few weeks now. But I don't know, how did the logo go? Did anybody notice?
So Christina gave all the stickers away before I think I even talked to her for the first time. So I'm guessing it was a very successful, but I did not get to see any firsthand responses.
Oh, shit.
It was unveiled at the business meeting. So Kara had it up on, or maybe they were your slides, but they were up on a big slide there. So folks definitely got a chance to see it. I think we avoided any pitfalls as far as being accidentally offensive, like we try to do our best at. So
yeah,
I'd call it a success.
I agree. I did send it around to folks and they did verify. Yeah, it's probably not a good idea. If you think it, someone else is going to think it. I'm like, true that, true that. I'm finally learning. It used to be like, no one's ever going to think that. It's like, wait a minute, but I did. So, yeah.
Well, and we did keep the sausage motif intact for the stickers. So we'll call that some brand continuity success.
We did. And it's not weird.
Not too weird.
Not too weird.
No weirder than the show itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Like, we throw a lot of stuff in that meat grinder, put it in that sausage. Oh, my Lord. Imagine eating the product of what we talk about. That'd be pretty gross.
Some weeks better than others.
I keep putting that he, him in my thing, and it's not appearing. Hello!
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. It's good to see you.
At long last. Did you go to LA? I did not.
I did not.
Okay, so we didn't miss each other there, yeah. So it's been a while.
Yeah. I think, like you, I just had a lot of life happened.
Eric just grilled me for it because, like, over the last 700 episodes, I've been like, at the next meeting where we're all, and then like 2 days before, I was like, guys, I'm having a fucking nervous breakdown. I can't do this. And they're like, good for you. Take a mental health break. Way to model and announce it on the podcast.
Well, and you know what I find is that we've been going to these things for a long time. So I kind of know how they go.
Yeah.
And turns out I missed seeing my friends, but I did not miss running around, going to talks, jumping in meetings, being on my feet all day. Didn't miss that part. So
turns out there's an arc and you don't stay in the same place your whole life.
Yeah.
I want to introduce you to Eric Griffith. He's my co-host today. He's one of the producers of the show.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
The show's called The Sausage of Science, and it's a riff on how the sausage is made. We always want to know how people's science is made, and we start with the scientist. So tell us about you. Tell us where you're from, what got you into anthropology, where you got into marmosets in Bloomington, Indiana, you know, all the crazy stuff. And your career, you have quite an arc. So if you could summarize that and tell us about some of the highlights, and we'll jump into the rest.
Well, let's see. Well, I mean, I'm from Ohio, so really did start there because I went to Miami University for undergrad. And I kind of searched for a major for a while. I was a chemistry major for a minute. And then I was a zoology major. And in search of gen ed credits and potential minors, I took an anthropology class. I think maybe my second year. The four fields, this is anthropology. And then they were all, you know, the things that I knew. And then they started talking about biological anthropology, which I had never heard of. But what I remember being struck by is that somehow Lucy the fossil and Jane Goodall were both in biological anthropology. It was kind of a never look back moment for me. And then I started taking classes with Linda Marchant and Bill McGrew. So my early training, my earliest introduction was really primatology focused, very chimp focused, which is kind of its own brand of primatology, really. When I decided to go to graduate school, I went into paleo because I was really interested in like fossil reconstructions of bipedality, because again, I was in love with Lucy.
So you were at Miami of Ohio?
Mm-hmm.
And they had, so we got so many Michigan people come on here. So it's really refreshing to hear about another undergraduate program. And also one that I almost went to. That's one where, well, I wouldn't say almost, I probably wouldn't have got in, but my friends went. I'm from Indianapolis. So I had friends that went there and anthropology wasn't on my radar at all. So I'm excited because this is the first time I've heard someone who went there and that there was a great anthropology department. I missed the boat in so many ways when I was in Indiana.
There's a real legacy of Miami undergrad. So Ben Auerbach, Rob O'Malley, they were all after me. I like to think I was one of the original ones that kicked it all off, but that's giving me a lot of credit when really the credit goes to Linda Marchant. So yeah, so then I ended up at IU. I was a few years in before I really realized that I don't think I was cut out for paleoanthropology, that it wasn't for me. Then that left the question, then what am I going to do? Because I've been in grad school a long time at this point. I mean, for your listeners who might be early in their journey, I just want you to know it took me 11 years to finish. I didn't have a dissertation topic. I did not have a dissertation topic until maybe year six. And look at me now. It's a rocky road, but
yeah, you know, I love those stories. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know, you look at people kind of where they are in their career and you can't imagine that there was ever a stumble, ever a question, you know, but there were many.
And many, many people, you're going to probably poo-poo this, but many people mm-hmm. think you're a rock star. So I'm sure hearing that will be great for a lot of people who are out there struggling, you know?
I hope so. I mean, I wish I had had that kind of model when I was in graduate school. Because I called them my lost years. Yeah. And they were the years where I was still trying to ride out this like paleo questioning period. And I was teaching anatomy. So in our program, bioanth PhD students were really encouraged to do a minor in medical sciences with an emphasis on anatomy. So like gross anatomy, full 2 years with the med students, that whole thing. And then we got hired in to teach in the medical sciences program. But at the time, they didn't pay tuition remission for us because we weren't in their program. So the only way you could teach was to carry credits, which you had to take out loans to pay for.
So how did you end up eventually, you know, transitioning from 6 years of paleoanthro to being interested in marmosets and reproductive justice?
Where it kind of came together for me was I did kind of experiment doing field primatology for a while during those last years. And what I found I was really interested in, I was studying howler monkeys, were mother-infant interactions. So I found this sort of behavioral hook that was really interesting to me. And I had been interested in, you know, what pulled me into paleo again was kind of evolution of the pelvis and obstetric processes related to that and how that related to bipedalism. So there were these things that were kind of related, and I was getting deeper and deeper in kind of falling in love with anatomy and in particular histology. So I got really interested in soft tissue and tissue anatomy, and still no idea how this is all going to go together. So I had the great fortune of doing one of these field schools with Paul Garber, another primatologist, and Michelle Bazanson, who was my TA at the time, probably know both of those characters. And I was just like, I think I have to drop out. I don't know what I want to do. And they said, Paul said, go to the library and get a stack of evolutionary anthropology and just read them with no agenda. And so I did. And what I found in my reading is that the papers that I loved were about marmosets. And I'd say that I started out my career with chimp people. Chimp people don't really tell you much about marmosets. They're not very, I mean, I don't want to, you know, paint with too broad a brush, but not too interested in primates that like look like rats. Just, I had multiple chimp advisors. So it wasn't just one, but I had one say like, why would they're basically rats. But they had such interesting reproductive physiology, their communal breeding system. It was all just so fascinating and brand new to me. And to find something fascinating and brand new 6 years into grad school, it just lit a fire. And so I cold emailed one of like the author of the papers that I liked the most, Suzette Tardif, down at the Southwest National Primate Research Center in San Antonio. And said, I think I'm interested in marmosets. And she said, well, why don't you to come down for the summer and I'll pay for you. Nobody had offered to do anything like that. And I was real interested in, I had just fallen in love with what I knew about marmosets, and they have litters and they have reproductive suppression, like ovulatory suppression. They're just weird, interesting little animals. And so I'm getting a tour of the lab, and she's like, well, there's our fume hood and the refrigerator and the ultrasound machine, because it did ultrasounds of pregnant marmosets. And then she said, and there's the cabinet where we keep the placentas. I'm not kidding. It was a light bulb moment, in that just sort of simple. And like, there's where the placentas are that we've kept, because it brought together anatomy, histology, physiology, mother, infant. It just was like, that's what I need to do. So now I need to learn everything about marmosets and everything about placentas, somehow make a dissertation out of it. When it all happened, when it all came together, it just felt so right and so clear.
It all goes together. No, I was going to geek out on your answer, but go ahead.
So the reproductive justice piece kind of, you know, my professional journey took me to the world of nursing. So that's where I've been a professor for, you know, 13 years has been in the world of nursing. So there are a couple of things that came together career-wise that led my work in that direction. So one was a theoretical framing of my work throughout, which was the developmental origins of health and disease, thinking about reproduction. But then it was the SAFE papers. It was the SAFE project. So that was the field work, the study of field work of sexual harassment and sexual assault and gender discrimination that I was engaged in with Kate Clancy and Katie Hind and Robin Nelson. That was a real eye opener about things that I already knew, you know, things that I knew in my own experience. But I think that, and then really as I started to really grow as an instructor in a midwifery and women's health nursing program, just kind of reinforced and grew my knowledge base and my perspective and my passion for reproductive justice work. And I started seeing the connections with my work in the marmosets, you know, a potential framework for rethinking some of those issues.
Let's go ahead and jump into some of the work you're doing right now, then, now that you've given us that great backstory. So we'll start with the womb-to-womb project that you sent us some reading on. And so what are the issues around stillbirth and neonate death, and how have those issues been used to blame mothers?
My questions come from is that we don't really know. We don't have a good handle. And this is the case for most of clinical work, right? And most of medicine is we don't really know. And part of the reason we don't really know why things happen is because we don't take a multifactorial, integrative systems kind of approach, because it's really hard to diagnose and treat things that are complex, right? So we are really focused on individual, whether genetic predisposition that probably doesn't actually exist, or it's singular lifestyle kinds of cause and effect, which also don't exist to the extent that sort of clinical science would like, because it would be much easier to treat people that way. That was kind of, you know, when I started looking at what I was finding in the marmosets, which was, so marmosets produce litters, multiple offspring per pregnancy, which is really weird. It's not what primates do. It's bizarre. It doesn't make sense evolutionarily. It's wonderful. It's just like one of the greatest, juiciest questions in evolutionary biology. What we, you know, kind of what I found in my work is that it's really different if you're a triplet versus being a twin. Like, it has consequences. It has meaning if you survive. And what I was finding is that triplet females, when they grow up, they get pregnant as often as the twins do, but they lose a lot more babies at various times in sort of a perinatal continuum. And that really got me thinking, like, there's nothing they could do to stop that. There's no intervention that we could point to and blame, right? And so when I started thinking about humans and seeing that, you know, a lot of clinical models, if you say, you think of all modifiable risk factors like smoking or alcohol consumption or obesity, which is, you know, a complicated thing. You don't prevent all of stillbirths. There's still a ton we don't know about. And so that's where I started putting those pieces together, because there are some people that we blame a lot more for their pregnancy outcomes than others. You know, my work with the marmosets showed me that that isn't really how the biology works, and it's certainly not how the embodied biology works.
So just to give listeners an example from a privileged perspective, which is me and my wife, like, we're privileged white people with access to insurance and everything, but I have triplets. They're during some of the early period when we were trying to get them breastfeeding, they were struggling to latch, and we were like, this was making us fucking crazy, you know? And we were getting shamed for not breastfeeding them all the time. We're like, Jesus Christ, is she a cow? Is she doesn't, yeah, like, she's not industrial agriculture ready, yeah, for triplets. So that's all me just sort of saying, yeah, the shame is real. And I can only imagine how much worse it is. And I have seen some of it in some of my work, even though it's peripheral. So I'm curious, now that we sort of have a sense of the model, how do you go about studying this?
So let me tell you a little bit about what makes marmosets so interesting in these questions. So, you know, I mentioned that they produce multiples, but they are not monozygotic. So it's multiple ova per cycle that the female produces. And so, you know, she has these three genetically distinct offspring, mixed sex litters, very common. The number of eggs she produces and thus the number of fetuses she carries varies with her body weight. So the heavier she is, the more eggs that she produces. And that's at the individual level and at the population level. So in a lifetime, if she's bigger, she'll have, you know, likely larger pregnancies. And then across the colony, that's the case. So what's fascinating to me as, like, somebody who's really interested in DOHAD, developmental origins of health and disease work, is that you have this intrauterine variability that is flexible, that is individual, that changes from pregnancy to pregnancy, where you can look at individuals who are distinct from each other and are experiencing that allocation of resources from mother to fetus in different ways. Each time you kind of add an additional fetus. So it provides, their physiology provides a sort of natural experiment where I don't have to do any diet restriction. I don't have to do any overfeeding. It's just, this is what they do. You know, where the work started was with those placentas in the cabinet, and then with some that I collected during my doctoral work, and looking at placentas under the microscope and measuring, quantifying microscopic surface area of the placenta. So I spent years just looking at marmoset placentas under the microscope, and they're beautiful, by the way. Placentas are gorgeous at the gross level. And I mean that in two ways, because it's a lot to look at.
And speaking of that, I was going to ask too. So my experience of marmosets, well, there's a couple of them, but the one that's most salient is at, mm-hmm, the Trevor Zoo in Millbrook, New York. Have you ever been there? It's a private school, but they have, yeah, tamarins and marmosets, and the indoor facility, the smell was so impactful. It was like a punch in the face.
Impactful
in there.
Is a great word.
So I was curious, smell. Yeah, about the colonies and the sort of, I guess, the circumstances that they live in, yeah, the marmosets.
Yeah, where I work at the Southwest National Primate Research Center, which is one of multiple NIH-funded primate research centers in the United States. So they are housed in family groups, in pretty naturalistic monogamous pairs. Marmosets and tamarins are in the wild are much more variably grouped. But they do well in monogamous pairs as well. So it's kind of the easier way to handle them in captivity. But then they will have their kind of multiple waves of offspring, because they can produce multiple, like about two litters a year, like every year. And again, twins, triplets, like you said in one of the questions, and we'll probably get back to that, a lot of babies. And the other thing about marmosets and tamarins, like the calotric and primates, including calamico monkeys, is that they have, they're big into anogenital marking. So that smell is, yeah, impactful is a good word. It's intense, it's pungent. So, you know, we would use ultrasound measures to predict a window for birth. And then I would go in, they give birth at night. So I would go in at night with a red light and sit there and wait for pregnancy, wait for labor. And, you know, the babies would be born and that would be a great moment. But I was there for the placenta, you know, that was my business. And I would keep with me a little bag of little marshmallows, like little hot chocolate marshmallows, because they really like to eat the placenta. Not all of them, not all the time, but like I worked really hard to get that placenta. So I would trade marshmallows for
you,
the
you'd steal the placentaphagy. And
I know. I mean, they worked hard for it too. But I had been in grad school for a lot longer than they had been. So
a lot longer than they'd been alive probably.
Yeah,
right?
So yeah. I needed them, but, yeah. So that was kind of the cool thing is like, you're seeing these, you know, pretty natural behavior and physiological processes unfold, because again, I wasn't manipulating the course of pregnancy in any way. So
since you brought it up, let's go into all of that baby that you observed. So yeah. You watched 14 marmoset females, 59 combined pregnancy, 140 infants coming to term. Can you just let our listeners know, what was the rate of stillbirth and early neonate death in that sample? And then what characteristics contributed to those negative outcomes?
Yeah, great question. The level of perinatal mortality is extremely high. It's extremely high in the wild, where you have predators and such. But, you know, I went back and I looked at the numbers of those 140 term pregnancies. We did have some miscarriages as well, but they're not figured into these analyses. 24 of those were stillborn. Then of the ones who survived, 43 of those died within the first week. And that's kind of where I ended my perinatal window. And, you know, we could extend it out, but that's kind of that first week period is where it's pretty intense loss. It tapers off as you're, you know, moving past that first week. So really what we're looking at was like a loss of about 48%. So nearly 50% perinatal mortality. They can offset that because they have so many. Some for like from a population perspective, it's not really an issue, but it raises some really fascinating questions about why do it that way? So we can come back to that question, which I do not have an answer to. Okay, so what kind of contributes? So what we found, so there are a couple things that happen. There are some infants that are born alive, but they start off not well. These are infants that were probably on the cusp of stillbirth, of not being viable. And it's not always size. So the larger the litter, the smaller, you know, this is one of the classic biological trade-offs, smaller birth weight, larger litter. Although as time has gone on, our birth weights, they're still maybe a little smaller for the big litters, but they're not small. It's not a size situation so much. We see kind of impaired motor function. And I just look at it, I kind of describe it as like you have infants that are born and they're just not sufficiently like marmoset infant. They just aren't cueing behaviorally or in a motor sense that they're viable. And marmosets are cutthroat. She's got multiples. So I've seen it. If an infant comes out and isn't immediately grasping, there's not a lot of assistance. And that's not the case for all primates, but it's for these guys, it's just, you know, and there are multiple caretakers, but in those kind of really early moments, they are crawling to mom. Sometimes they fall. They don't have the motor skill or the strength to hold on. And there's, again, not a lot of investment at that moment because there are others coming out and there are others that will hold on.
How many nipples do they have?
Two. Oh, they shit. Just have
okay.
Two.
Yeah. Right.
You know, they're primates.
So this there's is a why, brawl at the boob.
This is why it's fascinating. Yes, exactly. And there's a great paper that Suzette, my mentor, my marmoset lady, she and her colleagues wrote several years ago, and it was, can marmosets count to three? Which got a lot, like a lot of traffic from like cognitive people. They're like, can they count to three? And we're like, no, that's not what it's about. But it was about breastfeeding rates and breastfeeding behavior with triplets versus twins. And what's really interesting, and I think it's probably similar to humans. So kind of evolutionarily designed litter bearing animals kind of calibrate the amount of care they give to the number of offspring they have. They got a bunch of nipples. They can invest more or less time. Marmosets, it's like, this is how much time I have. I will nurse for 15 minutes. If you don't get to it, too bad. And so levels of aggression between like mother-directed aggression directed at the offspring is much higher from moms who have triplets. For that reason, she's like, get off, I'm done.
And literal fights among literal the infants fights. On top literal, of mom.
Literal fights, like mom is aggressing towards the kids. Mm-hmm. The kids are aggressing each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the animals, though, that die a little later in that first week, my hunch, and it's what, you know, this was a small analysis and not really powered, but just sort of an observation that we do want to look at in greater detail. But for those animals that died later in the week, they were born fine. They were born at a good birth weight. They were moving around. They were healthy. But when they died, they had lost a pretty significant amount of weight. You know, breastfed human infants can lose up to like 10% of their birth weight, and that's normal. So we were looking at animals that were losing an even higher amount. So that kind of leads us to think that maybe there is something different, you know, for those mothers who themselves were triplets or higher, even higher litter order. Perhaps the developmental scaffolding of both sort of the physiology of lactation, so potentially milk quantity, milk quality could vary and could be contributing to these differential rates of loss in that first week, in that neonatal week, or behavioral components of parenting that have really early developmental roots. And that's kind of, for that project, that's one of the places that, you know, I want to go next, is thinking through the developmental mechanisms that could actually help us understand these relationships.
Now let's talk about the other paper.
When I wrote the womb-to-womb paper, you know, I had the opportunity to have the kind of like the health equity, public health component. And I really encourage, and I've, you know, when I've talked to, you know, especially like in primatologists, where we have the opportunity to look at our work. And a lot of us are primatologists because we're sort of like evolutionary biologists, and we're not necessarily looking at, maybe we're looking at like evolutionary connections, but not sort of current societal, systemic, structural issues that our work could contribute to, even if just theoretically. And I just really encourage, like, even if you're doing, you know, field primatology and something that maybe just doesn't seem like it has a clinical connection, there's probably still something there that has really important philosophical relevance. And sort of, sort of maybe even taking that risk to make that connection is really worthwhile. That was one of my favorite parts of the paper, was just pointing out these, you know, triplet females in their adulthood, they can't go back in time and not be triplets. Their mothers didn't do anything. They're just living their lives and happen to have an extra ova. There's these physiological processes that are driven by sort of external lived experience for marmosets and for people. And we don't have any difficulty with that when we're thinking about the marmosets. And yet we have tremendous difficulty when we're thinking about these other primates. And so I just think there's a really important through line there. And I encourage lots of people who are doing work that doesn't immediately have that application to really think about the ways that they could inform that discussion.
I do like how bold you are in both of these papers and making assertions about historical inaccuracies, racism, misogyny. You mentioned Dohad, and the last question we had for that paper was really what you just said, but mm-hmm. our own theory, right? This is coming out of biological anthropology, developmental origins of health and disease. Also, if we're not critical of it, falls into this trap, which you point out in this piece, which I really appreciated that because I hadn't thought about that. And the very next article I read after that, I saw exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it puts it, it's another way to put tremendous focus on the individual when none of us, you know, I mean, in my deepest sort of like esoteric nerd thoughts, I'm like, none of us are individuals, man. Like,
yeah. But I mean, you're right.
We're all connected.
So you also sent us a paper that does similar work, right? Mm-hmm. So let's jump into that, right? Yeah. I read the title before you got on, so that's already there. So let's just start with, this gives us a little peek into what you've gotten to experience many years, medical training, nursing. We don't get to see a lot of that. And right out of the gate, you boldly state you're going to use the word obstetric body to describe people in this paper. Can you tell us what that is and why?
Yeah, so we were playing with the tension in that we were looking to historical literature and historical collections that are, you know, described and understood in very binary ways, both in terms of sex and gender. And we wanted to make the point, I think, because all three of the authors on that paper, so it was me, Carolyn Van Sickle, and Kylie Leese, and I think we all in our teaching of healthcare professionals as anthropologists were provocative, you know, kind of, because it's not really part of those kind of curricula about like, okay, what do we mean by sex and gender? What do you mean by population? What do you think race really is? Those are not questions that necessarily are asked. And so I think that was, it was part of that philosophical provocation, but like in an intellectually driven way of, we're talking about people generally who can give birth, and that doesn't necessarily have to fit into a binary description of sex and gender, that the obstetric body is one that contains a uterus that is capable or maybe not capable of holding a fetus and potentially giving birth, and that that body can belong to many different kinds of people or be inhabited by many different kinds of people. And it was an opportunity to make that point, even though we could not really use that language throughout the paper, because that's not how the phenomena and the bodies that were studied and implicated were described. While we were writing the paper, you know, it was invited for this special issue for American Anatomists. And so we were writing for that audience, or I think it was Anatomical Record. So we're writing for that audience, but hoping that our healthcare educators and clinician colleagues would find the paper and perhaps think about things in a very different way, because that's who we were really wanting to reach.
Yeah, so let's continue with that paper. You talk about the Caldwell-Molloy classification system. Can you let our listeners know what that is and how it's used?
I'm going to guess that, you know, anybody who's listening who has taken, you know, a basic kind of biological anthropology class or an osteology class has come across it. So the Caldwell-Molloy typology, it's a classification system of four types of pelvic shapes. Maybe even in the tone of my voice, you can like my skepticism about four types of pelvic shapes. The four types come about through these dimensions of clinical pelvimetry. So they're basically dimensions of the pelvis, which is a very complicated three-dimensional structure with an inlet and an outlet, and then like transverse dimensions and anterior posterior dimensions. It's incredibly complex. And so the idea of the typology is that you can look at the dimensions of, or the measurements, if I think about like three of those. I was reviewing the paper because it's quite technical. So I don't remember off the top of my head all of the different dimensions, but the combination thereof yields four types. And gynecoid, which the names sort of tell you what the takeaway is. Gynecoid is sort of the most female. And it's broad, and it's like the most, it's like what we think of as, it's what we've been taught is the very female, bowl-like pelvis. There's the android, and it's more compressed front to back. It's a little narrower. There's the platypaloid, and the platypaloid is really flat, like from anterior to posterior. It's super flat. It's not very common. It, as though it were a one thing, it is not very common. And then there's the anthropoid. An anthropoid is the more ape-like of the pelvic types. And so it's somewhat dimension-wise and shape-wise, it's somewhat intermediate between maybe android and gynecoid. So those are the four types, and you've probably seen the pictures of like the four pelvis shapes. What they were trying to do with their goal was like, can we determine what birth outcomes are sort of predicted by these different pelvic shapes that we can measure using clinical pelvimetry and thus maybe be able to predict birth outcomes? That was sort of the foundational purpose of it.
So like the timing of this was like the 1930s. So those terms, they sound like mongoloid and caucasoid, and like this is racial typologizing.
It absolutely is, because it was actually derived from a very clearly racist typology or description. It wasn't used for clinical terms. It was used to describe people alongside with like different cranial types, right? I think at one point there was more variation in the names of like the pelvic types for the sort of human racial classification than there were even for the cranial types. What Caldwell Molloy actually co-opted an existing framework that was very much that kind of standard.
And this quote from your paper, this isn't a quote from them, but this just, it's a wow. I don't have a question here. They sought to find interventions for patients whose pelvic morphology fit within normal human variation. Their premise assumed that normal variation of the human obstetric pelvis would lead to difficult births requiring clinical interventions such as surgical birth or forceps. How the fuck did our species survive this long if we require forceps to give normal birth? This makes no sense.
Well, so this whole typology that is still taught, it's taught in biological anthropology textbooks, and it is definitely still taught in midwifery today. The time when they were doing the measurements were on skeletonized pelvic collections, the Hammond-Todd collection in Cleveland, where there was sex data and race data of the time, but very unlikely there was obstetric data, gynecological data. Then they were using x-rays, measuring x-rays from women in labor, which you cannot even do. Like, that's not a thing anymore. So at no point, they're looking at static images and immobile skeletonized pelvis, and not of people who necessarily were actually having difficulty in labor. So the methodology was really weird, would not pass peer review for a number of reasons today. And this is one of those things that, you know, we deal with, like with the fossil record and reconstruction, is the static structure does not represent a living being in terms of actually moving and going through the physiological process, because the pelvis is very plastic. It is very, the different sizes of the dimensions are really dependent on position. And at that time when they were doing that study and looking at kind of difficult births, this was a period of time where women were lying on their back. If they were doing hospital births, it was a very medicalized procedure. Many of them were undergoing twilight sleep. So twilight, that's not a thing that probably subsequent generations know a lot about, but women were often like knocked out, opium-based, morphine-based drugs to just knock them out, which then necessitated instruments to get the baby out because she couldn't participate. So any relationship between pelvic dimensions and that kind of birth is meaningless. But those are the kinds of things that get lost, and we're left with a typology that is still presented as something useful. And so you still see on like new parent websites or pregnant, pregnant people websites looking for resources, tons of articles about like, is my pelvis big enough? Make sure you talk to your practitioner to make sure that your pelvis is big enough. So it's instilling this fear about dimensions that are in extreme pathological cases, they're important, but for most people, it does not have a bearing on the success of the birth.
So are these dimensions used for anything outside of, you know, on a textbook, maybe someone reads it and then they're showing up on Instagram or whatever, mommy blogs. Are they actually put into practice in any way beyond that?
So we know that they're still taught. And I'm not sure if this is your question, but we know I know that they're still taught because I taught them. I taught them for years up until writing this paper. Didn't question it. I was excited because it's like, oh, I learned about this in grad school as a biological anthropologist. And here I am in midwifery and I'm teaching it again. And like, look at these great connections. And it wasn't until working on this paper. So just talk about like kind of continual growth and evolution of our own work, where I was like, oh my God, like I have slides and slides and slides of here's a picture of a pelvis and here are the dimensions and it needs to be this long and you can add 2 centimeters or subtract 2 centimeters and that gives you the size of this and it's really important. And if it's not that long, then you're going to need to monitor pregnancy. Like it is still taught as an actual phenomenon for management, you know, for management of pregnancy. Now, it's still on the board exam. It's still like on the kind of like the credentialing exams that you would need to take to become like a certified nurse midwife. There are still questions about it. And so my last few years of teaching in that class, or a couple of years after the paper came out, I would tell them like, I have that information at the back of the lecture. You are welcome to go and review it so you can pass your exam, but I will not teach it anymore. And here's why. But I know you need it because you can't pass and become a CNM if you can't answer those questions, which is so messed up. We don't know the extent to which those measurements or that approach is used regularly in a clinical setting. That's actually some kind of qualitative work we would like to explore with like reaching out to actual clinicians. Like the extent to which it's actually used in practice, we're not sure. But it is still very much part of the curricula. And we have been, we've heard from people who are editors at some of the major midwifery and obstetrics textbooks who have read the paper and are considering at least addenda.
That's great. That's a policy education impact. That's an impact.
Huge. I mean, that was very exciting to have that kind of, I mean, it's one of the things I've loved most about being in nursing is the potential for the kind of stuff that we do to really open some eyes in a way that had the potential to change the way something was taught. I think it'll take a lot longer to get it into kind of the public sphere because people go on the mommy blogs, they read, you know, internet physicians that just keep, you can find that picture of the 4 different pelvic types all over the internet. And that feeds into fear. It feeds into people's fear of their capacity to carry a pregnancy and give birth. And all forms of birth are valid. And I'm not advocating for any particular kind. But what I'm saying is that there's enormous capacity to give birth. We're all still here.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
We've been doing it for a while.
Yeah. So that's why that quote was so asinine to me. I was like, that doesn't make any sense.
But it's like we can figure out how something is wrong here and treat it. But the flip side of that is that, or we cannot treat it. And by that, what I'm referring to is the higher proportion of Black women in the sample, and even now, that are characterized as having an anthropoid, ape-like pelvis, which has so many implications for sexuality, for reproduction. There's a wonderful quote from Deidre Cooper-Owens in the paper. I highly recommend her book, Medical Bondage. So good. It's a history of obstetrics in the United States. This notion that women, particularly enslaved Black women, were kind of designed for childbirth because they had really capacious pelvises that could sort of drop an infant without pain. And we still see that today. I mean, nobody would say that in the clinical setting. But what does happen is that Black women get epidurals less often. Their pain is not believed. They're given pain medication at a lower rate, even though they report higher levels of pain during labor. So that is still with us. And that is in large part because of what we think these pelvic measurements tell us and what kind of variation we've mapped onto that. That is very much constructed through a racist lens. So, you know, until we can really pull that apart, I mean, we have a lot of work to do.
Well, I want to thank you for sending us that paper. It was very cool. It opened my eyes. It got me thinking about philosophy. You always have done great work. Your impact on the field has been fantastic. I appreciate you. Appreciate you coming on the show and talking in depth about these things. We would love to have you back on down the road because I know you have so much more to talk about. And I want to ask you what you have coming up next, as you told us about all the wonderful things that you have going on. But I am going to ask our last question, which I just made up yesterday just for you.
Okay.
You can have the other question if you would like, but since the meeting's passed, it doesn't seem relevant. Our other question was, what talent are you going to display for us at the talent show that we're going to try to bring back? But since okay. I didn't even go to the meeting, I prefer, what is your superpower?
What's my superpower? Well, it's funny because I'm wearing like my professor t-shirt. And what I remembered is because the back says it's like, oh, because like, you know, superhero was already taken or something like that. So it seemed like it was appropriate. But I thought about this. And I mean, a special skill that I have that, you know, I don't know where it came from, but I am really good at putting together patterns and colors. So I don't know if it's a superpower, but it's definitely a talent. Like I can come and like put an outfit together and I can come and decorate. Like I can come to your home and decorate it and you'll just be amazed because I have a way of putting like patterns and colors together. That's pretty great.
Kind
of makes
neat
me
that.
Really happy. It's yeah. Like, it's my hobby and I always tell people like, if this like scientist thing doesn't work out, I'm still waiting for it to not work out. It keeps working out. So.
It keeps working out. I know.
It just keeps working out, you know? Pull me back in, right?
Our webmaster, Courtney's going to be jealous because she matched her outfit to her poster at the meeting. So she'll have gotten a kick out of this.
I approve. I always do that. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
This was great. Really fun.
Yeah,
this was really fun.
It's been a pleasure.
It
has been too long. So thank you for coming on.
Yeah. Well, hopefully Baltimore, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. How can folks find out more about you? What's the easiest way to get in touch these days?
Well, I'm on Instagram as Placentrix, Placentrix. And you will see a lot of my home decor photos and some work because, you know, there's a little bit in there.
Dog.
And then you can always, you know, and I encourage, you know, students, I'm in a college of nursing, but do you want me on your committee? Reach out to me. I would love to be on a committee.
All right.
And that would be jnrutherford@arizona.edu. That's probably the best way.
Yeah. And you listeners, we're the Human Biology Association, and Eric and I, or at least I, are on all the socials. It's Human Bio Assoc on the web, and I believe our Twitter/X. It's something similar on Instagram and Facebook. I'm at Chris_LY on Twitter and my name on everything else. What about you, Eric?
Email eric.griffith@duke.edu.
Keeping it simple, people.
Yeah, I think I'm on Threads and Blue Sky, but
I was on Threads for a minute. I forgot I got an invite to Blue Sky and never used it.
Yeah, it's a different world. It's a shame because I mean those there was some really good heady Twitter years.
Yeah, there were, and I didn't move on. I missed my child's entire trip to LA because he only communicates on Snapchat. So it's like a moving target, you know. Thank you again, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
All right.
Nice to meet you, Eric. Thank you.
You too. Have a nice afternoon, everyone.